This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Anatoly Karlin, and we're going to be discussing the Grey Tribe and other current events, including the election, pandemic, and economy news. And I'm also joined here with Dane Fitzgerald, who's going to be co-hosting.
Hello.
Always good to be on your show.
So, to start things off, Anatoly, you wrote this article about the Grey Tribe, and we discussed this topic on the show we did about Andrew Yang and the War on Normal People. About Andrew Yang's campaign was the closest to the Grey Tribe, but also it did, I mean, obviously it did overlap with the Blue Tribe as well. The initial context of this article was, it was about Scott Alexander, and there were threats to dox him on him about an article in the rationalist community. Yeah, I mean, was this the New York Times? And can you explain the background of who Scott Alexander is?
The whole thing about the red types and the blue types, it was something invented by Scott Alexander himself. The article is called something along the lines of I can't stand a group which doesn't tolerate the outside or something like that. I don't remember. But basically, the basic thesis is that society is usually broken down between two positions. And if you belong to one particular political tribe, then you have to adopt or you're encouraged to adopt all of its component positions. So if they identify as a Republican, then by analogy, you're also probably a climate skeptic, you're more economically libertarian, and you're against abortion, and so on and so forth. And if you're a Democrat, you are very much blank slatist. Think that the oceans will rise and wipe everybody out in the next 50 years. So you sort of have like a different set of perspectives. And the Grey Tribe is something that Yang just mentioned in passing, is that it's people who sort of don't really fit into either way.
Bo Weingard on Twitter, he put out a poll about, like, I think he said wokeness and then the handling of corona. And he said, like, if you're against woke culture and you believe in HBD, but at the same time, you also support taking the coronavirus pandemic seriously, and you accept, like, climate change, like, that kind of person would obviously be classified with, would be in the box of the Grey Tribe.
That sounds pretty Grey Tribe, yeah. I want to ask, what does Andrew Yang mean by war on normal people? By normal, does he mean, like, normal people in their sort of economic capacity as being average IQ, or does he mean, like, normal cultural sensibilities regarding gender relations, or what does he mean by that? I'm just curious.
Well, I mean, I wrote a review of that book, which you can check on the Jung's review, but basically his main shtick is that he's very much a believer in automation, and automation making a lot of jobs redundant. Well, I mean, there's a lot of debate amongst economists about whether that will happen, and if so, when precisely, but he thinks it's going to be a big deal, and most likely it's going to be the lower skilled people on average who will be more affected, although there'll be exceptions. because as we see with GPT-3, the AIs are becoming pretty intelligent in some respects. He's also he's also that Turchin, Peter Turchin, who has produced a lot of literature about the rising inequality, and Stark also has some articles. He published an article in the UNS Review about rising intergenerational equality. So really, by normal people, it's just the recognition that most people per se will have difficulties adapting. And yes, generally, this generally like sort of talking about what he means by normal people. Basically, the majority of the population who will find difficult to adjust to these different trends.
Okay, so he does mean normal people in their sort of economic capacity, not normal people as in, you know, patriotic conservatives with normal cultural views. Nothing. Okay.
He's a liberal. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. He's very much a liberal. I believe he's a crypto-atheist, but for obvious political reasons, he's not going to say that out loud, like Steven Pinker.
Yeah, I think he's thinking, and Yang is thinking primarily in economic terms. So, but he's not like excluding right-wing people or like Trump supporters in that category. By normal people, he pretty much means basically all Americans who are in the bottom, like 80-90%, regardless of politics or demographic profile. So, Anatoly, can you explain more in the background of a threat to dox Scott Alexander? The article. What happened with that, and was that article on the rationalist community ever published?
It wasn't, and Scott Alexander's blog has come back up, so I assume he actually said that it's probably now okay to carry on, because it seems that the New York Times has internally decided against publishing his name, his full name. I mean, it's not really hard to figure it out if you're willing to expend the effort, apparently, amongst the psychotherapists, a lot of them want to maintain a certain distance between their professional life and their public life, because it can be bad for patients if they know too much about them in what they do for like outside their professional roles.
I was just going to say there is in fact an important difference between the New York Times putting his name out there and, you know, the fact that someone could, if they're even a little bit determined, go find out who he is. You don't have to make it so much easier for someone doing, you know, a brief cursory bit of research by having it come up, you know, on the page one. So I see the difference there. It is important.
Totally. In the Grey Tribe article, you posted this pull on ideological labels. It's from something called the SCS community. Can you explain the context of that poll?
Right, I see, okay. Basically every year, Scott Alexander, he carries out a poll of his community, and Les Long used to do that as well, maybe it still does. So it's a pretty interesting sort of viewpoint into the demographics which lead those people, because I think on average pretty nonconformist, because secondly pretty like cognitively heterodox, as people call them, and secondly they're high IQ, so I think the average IQ at least which people name there is something like 135, which probably isn't actually too far off the reality, because the discussions on those blogs are really very high quality.
And just kind of to generalize, like the Grey Tribe, like the stereotype high IQ, nonconformist, and also I guess kind of nerdy, but different interest in different subject matter. AI, artificial intelligence, that's the appeal to Yang. Transhumanism, HBD, generally pro-science. Both the Red Tribe and the Blue Tribe will deny science, ranging from the climate change denialists to blank slateism, which actually mean both the Blue Tribe and the Red Tribe have embraced blank slateism. The thing is, like, the Red Tribe and the Blue Tribe, yeah, they're much easier to put in a box, like, politically. So the Gray Tribe includes a pretty... they're fairly politically diverse. So you have, like, libertarians, classical liberals, yeah, I mean, socialists. There's a leftist component for sure. Neo-reaction and even the alt-right. So they're not really, like, one distinct political box. But kind of that concept that we've talked about with Anatoly and I have talked about, like, the alt-center. I mean, that whole scene, it's a pretty small niche. But I do think, like, that does also kind of, like, alt-center or radical centrism also kind of captures, like, the Gray Tribe.
Yeah, I'm a little curious about the description as nonconformist. You know, it seems to me a lot of these guys are comfortably employed programmers for large corporations or at least, you know, these startups, many of whom or most of whom include people who went through the typical elite higher education channel to derive where they're at. You know, so that sounds a little self-flattering, but I, you know, maybe there's some way that they mean it that could be a little better defended. I mean, I imagine someone who's writing for, like, Babe.net in Brooklyn, who hates these people, as, you know, as have as much a claim on being a nonconformist as they are, you know, as she's, you know, dealing with mental unwellness and drugs and alienating people all around her. That's, you know, I don't agree with that, but it's not conformist. So I don't know. I wonder about that descriptor of the Gray Tribe SSC folks as, you know, anti-conformist. You know, anyway.
Oh, well, I mean, there's obviously different kinds of nonconformism. So there's the sort of, like, the structure nonconformism is like it exists, but I mean, it doesn't really have a point to it, and it's ultimately not that interesting. You don't generate a lot of ideas out of it. So, like, if you look at where the scientific revolution exploded, and where a lot of the like revolutionary economic and political ideas came out, it was originally in the coffee salons of Western Europe, where basically the Enlightenment appeared, and that was like the sort of the first civilization which generated those ideas, and probably my guess is that you had some critical threshold being reached of IQ multiplied by literacy rate multiplied by nonconformism factor, because China was very developed as well, very urbanized during that period by some economists' estimations, perhaps even more so than Western Europe. Perhaps personality factors sort of preempted a similar explosion.
Yeah, so there is pulling a demographic breakdown on this article you did on coffee salon demographics. So coffee salon is, just to kind of explain, it's not a specific organization. It's just a term to describe these, like, groups of thinkers throughout history that lead to innovations, both cultural and technological discoveries and political change. How change in society occurs by a select few. And it does, it's not just sort of like the Gray Tribe, but there's also pulling on Occupy Wall Street. So, I mean, Anatoly, do you want to comment on some of these demographic pulling on that article, Coffee Salon Demographics, like, includes, like, transhumanism and Gray Tribe oriented groups?
Yeah. Well, yeah, sure. In a nutshell, I think that these sorts of out of left field communities, they're sort of like the equivalents of the people who would gather at coffee salons in prior times. I mean, in the online space, you have those less known people and so on. In online space, back when I was in the Bay Area, I used to frequent the East Bay Futurists, which is...
Oh, yeah, so is that the same one? Actually, to give some information, Dane Fitzgerald and I, we actually met at Scott Jakich's Futurist Meetup. It was in San Francisco.
Okay, yeah, well, yeah, I mean, this is the sort of thing I'm talking about. And, they do have some pretty interesting demographics. So I mean, the most sort of like the biggest difference, which stands out, but which probably won't surprise anybody when they think about it, is that it's 90% male, as is Lestong, as is SCS, and so on. Why is that the case? Probably because women are psychologically more conservative, so there doesn't seem to be a big IQ difference or any IQ difference in terms of averages, although as well known, women have a slightly smaller standard distribution. But even so, it's not nowhere near enough to explain the difference, so there must be some sort of personality factor attached. We know that from like Charles Murray's Human Accomplishment and other databases that for some reason or other, women are much less creative in terms of coming up with different innovations. And that's despite the fact that women's rights have advanced very much in the past century. But a century ago, they were producing 2% of the world's big innovations, as proxied by, say, Nobel Prizes, and today it's the exact same figure, 2%. So is it a matter of sort of structural sexism? Well, bearing that in mind, I'm not so sure. And of course, there's also ethnic differences. It's probably not surprising that blacks are very much underrepresented, but what is surprising, however, is that East Asians are also pretty represented. So white people are almost 90.
The demographics, of the Bay Area futurist or rationality crowd. It's really the latter, right? Not specifically Bay Area, but rationality crowd.
I mean the people who list the sponsors to the Les Thong and to this Scott Alexander's work opinion
polls. Yeah.
And also Hank Pellissier, he also did a survey of transhumanists a few years ago, and it was basically the same story.
Okay, it shook out to be about the same thing. That's interesting.
I saw the statistics on those polls. Yeah, mostly overwhelmingly white, about 80-90% white. Yeah, overwhelmingly male, like 80-90% male.
Which trans people than you would expect too. So there's,
yeah,
you know, in some
kind of like neurodiversity, that movement, like there is a wing of neurodiversity that is more kind of woke or SJW, but there is actually overlap with the neurodiversity community. Like a lot of people on the spectrum interested. Yeah, I mean, the Grey Tribe, it does attract a lot of people, like, with Asperger's.
That could be a specifically, you know, West Coast American, Northeast and West Coast American thing influencing that.
It could be the case. And the thing that's interesting is there's a significant Jewish overrepresentation, but not Asian.
Yeah, exactly. Jews are like 10%, even though it's 2% of the U.S. population. And funnily enough, both of the two really, like, out of the, like, who are the, probably the most famous quote, nationalist quote? They would be Scott Alexander, Eliza Yudkowsky, and Robin Hanson. Two of those people are Jews.
What would you say, like, when you attended futurist meetings, like, what would you estimate is the overall, like, demographic breakdown? As far as
I mean, it correlates with what you've described pretty much.
Because there is like, isn't there is like a strong Asian presence in Silicon Valley?
Yeah. But they're not really the sort of people who go to such meetings or chit chat. Oh, I mean, there are some of them, but it's not like they don't exist, but they are not overrepresented. They are like even slightly less as a percentage of the population in those communities than they are as a share of the U.S. population.
Or like Razib Khan is he's South Asian, and the blogger J-Man, like, he's of Jamaican origin, and both of them really, like, they epitomize the Grey Tribe.
Yeah, I wonder to what degree that Asians are represented. It skews South Asian more so than East Asian. It looks like maybe Razib Khan is the only person we have to go on to try and determine that. And if that's the case, then I'm going to go with South Asian, but I don't know.
If you think about it, that's sort of corresponds to the Caucasian Mongoloid division that we've been talking about. And even historically, if you think about what have the Chinese and the Indians invented, the Chinese made the four great inventions: the compass, the paper, the printing press, and the gunpowder. So like really practical things. And they came up with a bunch of numerical methods, although that was more the Japanese, actually. The Indians invented the concept of the zero. So historically, history of science, the stereotypes pan out.
So I know that in leadership positions in Silicon Valley, it leans more towards South Asian representation.
Oh, yeah. Steve Staler, he wrote this article. It was titled... The Bamboo Ceiling versus the Madras Floor, because both of those groups, they do excel academically, but there is this disparity in leadership, corporate and tech leadership.
Yeah, like executive skills, C-suite type of stuff. Yeah, it tends to skew South Asian. So that I'm gonna chalk that up as a sign that to the degree that Asian is represented in the rationality community, I know it's not large, it probably is more South Asian than East Asian. Because you also have the entire Brown Pundits blog, which is sort of like Razib Khan.
Oh yeah, I listened to that Razib Khan's blog. The other side of it is with the Great Tribe angle, it does seem like South Asians are probably politically more to the left than East Asians. I've also heard that theory.
Yeah, and interestingly, that ends up, though, because they even care about politics, they end up a little more tuned into kind of the rationality crowd and what they're talking about.
I think a parallel between... I think there's a parallel between like South Asians and Ashkenazi Jews. So Ashkenazi Jews are disproportionately liberal, but they do also contribute a lot to dissident political scenes, like Ron Unz and a lot of Great Tribe figures as well. So I think that's a good comparison.
Right. I mean, at least they have a head for politics to begin with, and so you'll end up in some interesting places because of that alone, you know.
And then Zach Goldberg had an interesting graph. I'll link to it on the show post, and it shows like in-group preferences by on the political spectrum. So with blacks and Latinos, there's the strongest in-group preference on the left. What is fascinating is with both whites and Asians, the strongest in-group preference is actually in the center rather than the right. And with whites, I think the whites who identify as strong conservatives, they're focused on economic and social conservatism, and that's kind of a parallel to how a lot of and this is just these are just general white people. But a lot of people who are classified as alt-right will get centrist on the political spectrum score. So that sort of makes sense. With Asians, you have like Asian SJWs who support affirmative action, which is not really beneficial to their group interest. And then conservatives, a lot of the, I'm sort of just estimating that those are probably people who are more focused on religion, so the centrist. So, I mean, Anatoly, do you have any thoughts on why in Zach Goldberg's graph, it shows whites with the strongest in-group preference among centrism rather than the right?
Huh. So Robert, you're saying that among whites who identify as centrist have a stronger in-group bias than whites who identify as right-wing?
That's what this study from Zach Goldberg that he posted claims.
Huh.
I'm a bit confused because from what I generally recall of what Zach posted recently, it's that it's leftist. Whites who have the lowest amount, they actually have negative group.
So
you were saying that the centrist whites have higher group preference than other races, or
that's what it seems to be. It is.
I wonder why they're centrist. They must be. Their views are being gauged in other ways that mark them as centrist.
Well, if you look this is like a broader selection of people, but if you look at specifically like those who get labeled as the alt-right, so if you look in a movement like the alt-right, it overlaps with the Great Tribe, but there's also like there is a kind of good versus evil morality, which is maybe closer to the Red Tribe. I think a lot of people get into that scene, not so much necessarily out of any like racial resentment, but a lot of cases Like, there's all these people who are politically homeless, like the kind of people who are anti-war, pro-environment, reject blank slateism, pro-science, but anti-woke. And yeah, sort of the gray tribe, that was we would describe, and they're politically homeless, so they just kind of, a lot of, I noticed when the Richard Spencer's alt-right scene took off, like they got, that a lot of those types just kind of got, went along with that. Because they didn't have a home in the blue tribe or red tribe or libertarianism.
I can think of one way in which, you know, those who identify as right-wing would have less in-group preference. It might be reflective of a more kind of, you know, educated conservatism who have basically been educated into sort of a classical liberal universalism. And so those who are not educated in that way just are displaying a sort of normal but non-ideological. When I imagine the, you know, the woman I might marry one day, yeah, I mean, basically looks like a white lady. I mean, just like my mom. I mean, I just, you know, something like that. It's like, it's not, you know, indicative of some kind of a racist preference, at least not as they would conceive it. Maybe the woke would conceive it that way.
Yeah,
but, you know what I mean?
That's basically what it is that the blue tribe and the red tribe, they have their ideology, they're defined by their ideology. So if you're a conservative, it's basically opposing abortion and low taxes and Americanism as an ideology. If you're not hyper ideological, you kind of revert back to the more basic, like base tribal instincts.
Yeah,
that's the conclusion I would jump to.
You know, they're essentially the people identifying as right in this instance are basically overwhelmingly sort of think tank rightist. You know, something
yeah.
like that. I don't know.
Anatoly, what are your thoughts on people who speculate that Elon Musk is part of the gray tribe? I think like a lot of these like dissidents like to fantasize like that he's secretly like red pilled.
I mean, it's a long tradition, this sort of thing. You look all the memes about Taylor Swift, uttering the 14 words and stuff.
Yeah, it's always been kind of that theme where they select a figure from the mainstream, they become a symbol for what they believe in. So, like, how would you? He's obviously like very a strong He's very kind of a strong focus on science. He's pro. He has endorsed. Like UBI, I think he expressed some sympathy for Andrew Yang. So, yeah, I mean, there are, like, gray tribe themes. I would probably say that, I think overall he's sort of a, like, neoliberal centrist who maybe kind of flirts with gray tribe themes. But I think it's...
Well, he's basically a businessman, Chad. So
yeah.
With some very serious technical talent, obviously, and a great deal of energy, because he runs the different companies at the same time. So Tesla, SpaceX, the Boring Company, and Neuralink. Oh, that's a fourth one, actually. So that's very impressive, and a massive talent which exceeds all those other talents for salesmanship. Because a lot of people basically worship him. He's a cult symbol. That didn't just emerge out of thin air. So he's especially talented in terms of image making.
Yeah, that image might come more from the fact that, or it could stem more from all the politics happening around him. You know, I mean, if he is a sort of figurehead for the Silicon Valley, this emerging Silicon Valley war against the Northeast journalistic establishment, it just feels natural to think of him as some kind of gray tribe fellow traveler. But it might not be coming from anything that he's really said that gives him away. It's just where he is just sort of naturally positioned in this great ideological panopticon that we're living in. I don't know.
Or he did
like
say,
that.
It was interesting, is he did say, like, one time he said briefly that he supports smart socialism and, like, smart socialism as opposed to egalitarian socialism, and that's kind of... But it is something like Giovanni Donato, the blogger, he talks about that, like, smart socialism is statism, but investing in advancing civilization rather than egalitarian principles. So that's a very gray tribe concept. Anatoly, do you have any thoughts on the whole controversy about Jeffrey Epstein's involvement with transhumanism?
That's a bit of an out of left field question. I suppose he had a lot of diverse interests, and transhumanism was one of them. And if you look at what he was doing, he was meeting up with all sorts of socialites, and he obviously had very prodigious networking skills. And I mean, it's pretty clear that he was a honey trap for some intelligence service, or possibly multiple intelligence services. Obviously that was sort of thing that that they'd be interested in looking at. And incidentally, one of the manifestations of his transhumanism, it was actually a pretty weird transhumanism. I think it revolved entirely around some pretty fringe ideas about like freezing his dick or something like that.
He had some fantasy about like breeding lots of descendants.
And that as well, yeah, like opening a farm, a breeding farm or something like that, yeah. I think it's basically like some like really weird ideas which are very tangential to what normal consumerists actually like discuss. And it's pretty clear it was a pretty tangential interest of his, and there were many other things that he was more obsessed with, like those weird occult temples he was building on his island, with the you know, the portraits of Bill Clinton and stuff like that.
That seems to have captured
a lot more of the public attention. But frankly, the most notable factor about it is that it's not like anybody is really paying attention to it anyway. So
It's funny you mention that, because today on trending on Twitter is hashtag Bill Clinton is a pedo. So
oh yeah.
He's starting to get some attention, right?
Yeah, but, you know, the whole thing with the release of documents with Ghislaine Maxwell. I think the other thing was there's allegations of sexual racism. There were allegations of racism, but the thing about like Epstein,
he preferred a certain race of victim.
Yeah, with his victims, exclusively excluding African Americans. So
this is a case where being excluded and being a victim of racism is better, I'd say.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, sexual racism is kind of a new kind of a woke cause. It used to be just more. It used to be like on the left, it was just about freedom to date whoever and marry whoever you want. But the thing about like Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, I mean, obviously they are criminals, but the thing is, about the values of the elites, like versus the values that are opposed onto the masses, like they're how representative, like are those values of elites, and do they actually follow the same values imposed on the masses?
I mean, if you want to get really conspiratorial, then one point you could make is that many societies have a mechanism through which they control and discipline their elites, because you don't want your elites becoming too fractured, because that way they can start mobilizing parts of the sort of lumpen thrones against the other elites, and then you get revolutions and unrest and so on. So in Russia, for instance, it's done through systemic corruption. So there's a lot of corruption, and if you get to the top, you can't really not be corrupt to some extent. And with China, there's a lot of corruption as well, but there's also a more sort of overt punitive element, where if you like start becoming too rich or too divergent from the CPC, then you'll have some criminal case launched against you. Following in this sort of same sort of speculative doubt, perhaps the Western societies, Western elites also have an internal control mechanism.
That's what I think is one of the key factors of cancel culture and deplatforming, is they want to purge divergent views out of the elites. So what Peter Turchin talks about is elite overproduction leading to civil unrest. Like what causes civil wars and revolutions is it's not just like the proletariat is not going to matter if the elites are unified, but what happens is there is a there there's divergence within the elite, and even if you look at like dissident movements that have failed to garner any support from the elites, usually fail. I remember Anatoly, you brought that up on our on our show we did about the Yellow Vests with Guillaume Durocher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even Che Guevara was the son of lawyers, if I recall. You've got to win, you know, you've got to win them over in some degree. But there was a new article by...
Is this the one about the horseshoe, the double horseshoe theory on how political movements are factored in by class structure? So I think it's called like a double horseshoe. So at the top you have the plutocracy, ultra elites. Then on the right side it's the petty bourgeois, like a lot of small business owners and industrialists. Then the left side is the managerial class. Then the bottom is the proletariat. Which groups emerge together in alliance determines like what kind of politics we get, whether it's like neoliberalism, left populism, or right version of that.
Right. Yeah. So the kind of petty bourgeois is the sort of a Tea Party base. The long tail of small businesses, and the way that maps onto current coronavirus politics, for instance, is they're the ones screaming for things to reopen. You know, their back is up against the wall existentially as far as their ability to continue their livelihood. So they want things to reopen, whereas the kind of work from home adjunct professor types, the kind of sort of corporate functionaries, that's kind of what I do right now. They're fine staying home. But anyway, in any case, both those groups are feeling increasingly angsty and concerned about where they are in the future, what the future has in store for them. And a lot of the culture war we're seeing now is basically those two sides, you know, hurling accusations at each other. You know, you have the credentialed professional class, but not the elite, but credentialed professional classes who went to college, telling these small business folks that you're killing people by wanting to reopen things, you know, and then you have them lobbying back, you know, the credentialed bourgeoisie that no, you're. It's easy for you to say that because you can work from home, blah blah blah. So a lot of what we're seeing now is just a reflection of those two groups fighting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That does seem to be the case. And back to Scott Alexander, he predicted that Trump becoming president would radicalize a younger generation into a totalitarian social justice left. And it does seem to be the case that with Trump's abysmal handling of the pandemic and economic crisis, even though that the Great Awakening began significantly before Trump's inauguration. So this election, it is really polarized between the blue tribe and the red tribe. Would you say both of you are pessimistic about any kind of political, like a gray tribe-oriented political movement ever taking off in the near future?
I don't think it will happen because there's very few of them, and there's no reason for normies to support this. At most, they'll be able to lobby some of those ideas through to one of the tribes who actually have the numbers to do anything in the scene politically.
No, I mean, a Biden presidency might just be the kind of perfect centrist opportunity for gray tribe people. Someone more woke than him is not going to be amenable to it for reasons that we already are discovering with the Silicon Valley versus New York Times type of squabble. And then, of course, Trump, I don't really, you know, if Peter Thiel abandoning Trump is any indication, I don't think it's not a good home for that either. And the last 4 years hasn't seen much of a Andrew Yang style thinking being perpetuated by the Trump administration. So maybe Biden really is that sort of ground.
Yeah, some people, it's hard to say what happened to Biden because I know a lot of, like, conservatives, normie conservatives and dissident rightists, they're predicting that he could be used as a vehicle for a radical left to take power, but he could very well just be kind of a standard neoliberal like Bill Clinton.
You know, there's a blogger named Gray Enlightenment. I feel bad that I can't say the person's name. It still feels amateurish to just refer to the name of the blog as the person, but, you know, what can I do? And he's saying that he thinks that a Biden win will actually pull back some of the overzealous woke stuff, especially in regards to tech censorship. It's basically all because of Trump. In other words, even Scott Alexander, you know, as far removed from Trump as he is suffering because of Trump. Blame Trump. So if Trump is out, maybe the woke stuff will be taken down a notch.
Yeah, maybe deplatforming was less bad under Obama, but the problem is, like, the momentum has been building. The momentum behind that in that direction is too powerful. I don't see it, like, backtracking that much. Biden could possibly de-escalate things a bit, but yeah. I mean, it's just so entrenched. I do want to comment on this article about California, and Dana and I are obviously California natives. Anatoly lived in the Bay Area a significant amount of time, and the kind of perception and stereotype that California is unanimously and uniformly liberal, when it's actually a fairly strong gray tribe scene there.
I'm not sure if it is. I think what will happen with Biden, under Biden presidency, is that his platform is more aggressive than Hillary Clinton's was in 2016, amazingly enough. So I think there'll be a tremendous sort of disillusionment from both sides of the political spectrum in respect to that, from populists of both the left and the right. So that's going to make for continued instability. I don't really expect the sort of interesting happenings to die down in the U.S. Anytime soon.
Depressing counterfactual is what I'm basically suggesting. Because yes, I would agree that we're going to see it get worse. But all, you know, I'm making, like, just the humble observation that it would be getting worse even faster, you know, if Trump won again. Either way, you are going to see it get worse.
Yeah, could very well get worse under Trump. It just seems like, regardless of who gets elected, it's a really bad situation regardless. So yeah, with California, New England, puritanical origins of, like, the northeastern United States, there's this kind of theory about how different, this map that shows how different sections of the nation were settled. But it's hard to say how relevant it is today. But I will say California has this history of attracting a lot of free thinkers and eccentrics, and yeah, kind of an overall trait of openness. And it is a major kind of center of the gray tribe. Transhumanist scene does seem to be heavily centered in the Bay Area, Silicon Valley. You have rationalist. The original, like, early PUA scene was very much, it did come out of L.A., like the neo-reactionary thinkers, Uns Review writers, like Steve Saylor and Ron Uns. Obviously us, all three of us have the connections, and then also the more kind of nation-focused wing of conservatism, like Stephen Miller.
Yeah, the West Coast was actually, you know, obviously settled later within, you know, a sort of... settler-type country, colonialist-type country. So it was actually settled later, which also means its ideological profile has been settled later and is still somewhat more in flux compared to the Northeast, you know? So you do see a little more heterodoxy. But, I mean, in enough time, with enough more time passing, that could be snuffed out. It's not, not as dynamic,
like,
as it was.
Yeah, like, how long it's sustainable. So, like, rising cost. Because, basically, you know, the thing is, California is insanely expensive. Both the blue tribe and the red tribe will think high prices just price out, like, in the right-wing case, would be, like, the undesirables. And in the left's case, it would be pricing out people, poor people who are the lumpen proletariat they're sympathetic to. But I think the other factor is, like, intellectual and artistic and scientific innovation and endeavors, they do need a sort of leisure class. And as places like the Bay Area and LA, Silicon Valley, they become more hyper competitive. I think that is actually, in some ways, that is, like, bad for innovation. Kind of like how that era, like in the case of New York, how not so much science, but there was a lot of cultural innovation, like arts and music, from New York in the 70s and 80s when there's more, like, poverty and crime. So I think. Yeah, you think, like, becoming more high, we do need, like, a leisure class for for this kind of innovation. And then also think like council culture is also like purging free thinkers out of, basically denying them of a chance of becoming part of the elite. So these are, these are trends which could forebode poorly for a great tribe thriving in California.
I thought it was sort of ironic that California, despite its hyper progressive rhetoric, has created an economy that is just so ruthlessly Darwinistic, and yet North Dakota, you know, which is much more Republican, anyone can basically jump into fracking or whatever, you know, open a subway franchise out there and do about as well as anyone else.
Public banking, public banking in North Dakota, and then Alaska has like the citizens' dividend from oil revenue. Like we have this oil production off the coast, and we don't even have like a citizens' dividend for that here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, to be honest,
stuff with people who complain about inequality. It's very expensive to surround yourself with people who are progressive, somewhat ironically, right? So that, I thought that was kind of strange the way California's trajectory has been.
I think Lion of the blogosphere, I mean, this also captures like the great tribe. He proposed like providing public housing for people who are high IQ, but also economically disadvantaged.
Yeah, the smart poor. I remember that article. And, you know, it's weird because trying to stake out a politics like that is so difficult because it really does cut across certain shibboleths, you know, held by left and right. And
yeah, because the left, the blue tribe will say that it's anti-egalitarianism, or even they'll even go as far as to say it's outright racist.
Be smart, right?
Yeah,
you have to be smart.
Yeah.
I honestly think it's not just smart. It's all, you know, it's smart and well behaved, and well, you know, well behaved and smart. So it's actually a little more inclusive of, to use a buzz term, kind of normie heartland conservatism that doesn't put on a pedestal high IQ. You know, that sounds elitist and shitty to them too. You know,
Republicans. Like a kind of in some ways like Trump. Like Trump would obviously not be sympathetic to that because he epitomizes someone. I'm not questioning his IQ, but he sort of symbolizes this trope in America of someone who's wealthy but kind of crass and not hyper intellectual. So I think a lot of Republicans tend to emulate those types. So I think this idea of like building a public housing or building communities for the smart but poor or the creative but poor, that does just epitomize like great tribe thought.
Yeah. And I would be a little more normie populist than that, though. I would want to stake out a place for people who are poor and not especially bright, but perfectly well-meaning, well-behaved. They show every indication of wanting to be part of a healthy community, you know, all of that kind of stuff, too. Because I see a lot of dysfunction among the lower class, too. So if you could take that away and still be left with people who aren't especially bright, but I think there should be a politics that includes them as well, you know?
Yeah. But that would be more inclusive to be more like demographically inclusive, of course. So, Anatoly, do you have any more comments on California as an engine for political and for dissident political thought and all these other intellectual endeavors?
Well, I mean, it's not the first time I've had this thought that California is substantially more heterodox than the Northeast, even though it's about equally leftist liberal. But I mean, the West Coast, its liberalism is more of a libertarian bent, in my opinion. Although, who knows? I mean, I left almost 5 years ago, so don't really have recent on-the-ground experience to substantiate that.
This is a little bit off-topic than we were discussing about the Grey Tribe, but you wrote about outliving your usefulness, and this movement that's come out of the George Floyd protests, Antifa, BLM, what will become of this? Like, whether they'll be like useful for elites to divert energy into kind of woke signaling over populism and class war. We talked about this kind of woke capital trend on our last show. the theory that economic elites promote race-based identity politics to distract from like class war. So if there's systematic white oppression, then that distracts from the oppression of the economic oligarchy, like that theory. And I think the best example, like this is almost like parody from like the woke capital Twitter account, but this trend, it's like basically outright a woke austerity, Chevron laying off workers to improve diversity ratios, like those kind of the issue is like whether this movement will be absorbed in that kind of like neoliberalism, or could they actually evolve into something that will challenge plutocratic economic interest? And yeah, I think Ron Unz actually did predict that they actually would.
Well, I think it depends on the U.S. trajectory, on how sort of like the dangerous the sort of the far left, the Chapo Tap House crowd will be. Because if the U.S. will just continue to coast along, limping obviously, then I don't think there will be a threat. If on the other hand there's some sort of collapse, perhaps another sort of military adventure goes badly, who knows? Anything can happen. One thing that I think might be happening in the U.S. is that the radical far left in the U.S. is much more extreme than Europe. I mean, I know that they say that Bernie Sanders is like this typical European conservative sort of person. Well, I mean, that's nonsense. His actual policies, like the big wealth tax, $20 billion, $1 trillion on the New Green Deal. This is much more far leftist than like even most European communist parties. These people continue becoming disillusioned and being shut out of politics. And if there's some sort of shock which shifts support towards that direction, then you could see some real revolutionary potential.
Yeah, I have predicted this in the past. So if the economy manages to kind of rebound somewhat and it's we kind of return to the stagnation we did in the last few years, then the whole kind of we could just see a continuation of like woke neoliberalism. But like what will happen with the economy? So one thing that has been keeping the economy afloat is these unemployment benefits, and they just expired, and Congress and the Senate and President Trump have pretty much screwed up the handling of this. And if a lot of people, it's not just the hardship of the people losing out on unemployment. The revenue is necessary to keep the economy going and preventing a collapse. So we could see like a real economic crisis.
That's interesting. I wonder to what degree, saving people from being evicted, from having no money to spend, not only on bills, but the local economy, how much they, a lifeline might be thrown to them, be thrown to them in order to just keep elite capitalists afloat, right? So, I mean, we like just kind of normal Keynesian thinking. We need to inject demand into the economy. So, I mean, it's in their self-interest to do something minimally welfare, right? I don't really see a totally Lyceum type world coming into play. But anyway, I have to go right now.
Okay. Nice talking to you guys. Dane, it was great talking to you, and I'll have a few more topics with Anatoly before I wrap up.
Okay, sure. See you, Dane.
All right. Take care, Anatoly.
Take care.
Bye, Robin.
So yeah, Anatoly, so you did post this post, mask wearing as an IQ test, like relevant to HBD, and it seems like there actually are like normie conservatives who will flat out refuse to wear a mask as a sign of rebellion or resistance.
Actually, that particular post was there was an interesting experiment a couple of decades ago, I think, or two or three decades ago, where they put a sort of covering over a baby's head, The European babies were resisting it, they didn't like it, and the East Asian ones were okay with it. So I was just speculating that there might be some HPT reasons apart from just like intelligence and conscientiousness and so on. Because even amongst Europeans, it seems to me at least, not just based on statistics or on opinion polls, and also just on personal anecdotes, like cases of people I'm familiar with and friends with, that it seems to me that South Europeans are more tolerant of mask wearing than North Europeans.
It's less with the kind of blue versus gray blue versus red tribe divide as it is in the United States. Like I sort of do understand the arguments about like the lockdown crashing the economy, but the people who just flat out refuse to wear a mask, I mean, that's totally insane. So the last show we did was I think about a month ago, like right after the reopening and also the protests, and there was, so we did see like a big spike. And now that spike seems to, especially like here in California and Florida and Texas, were hit pretty bad. And that's kind of at its pinnacle, and it's gradually heading back down. But before I wrap things up, I do want to ask one last question. Anatoly, how viable is do you see like a vaccine for the coronavirus? Like there actually are some people saying it's possible there is a chance we can never actually come up with a vaccine and we may have to just kind of live with this.
Well, that would be very bad, because if people get reinfected, then I did some calculations at the beginning of this outbreak that if it becomes a seasonal, so sort of a yearly thing, which infects 10% of the population in any one year, then at sort of death rates of 1%, then it will result in a drop of life expectancy of around 2 to 3 years in the developed world. So that would be pretty bad, obviously. But I don't think that I think a vaccine is actually perfectly viable. That it seems to be trending that way. The problem with making vaccines against the cold, which is it's the typical cold is also a form of coronavirus. The problem, though, is that there's lots of different coronaviruses which cause colds. So that's the first problem. You likewise would need to make lots of vaccines, and they're constantly like changing. And secondly, the second problem is that the cold isn't like life-threatening. So there's no like urgency to make a vaccine against the cold. So they're not really comparable situations. The coronavirus is a pretty distinct coronavirus, first, and secondly, it actually is very quite dangerous. So there's a lot of incentive to do that, and lots of companies are now moving into the sort of beginning to move into mass testing phase on a larger scale. So I would expect to see vaccines in mass production by the first half of 2021.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see what happens with that. Anatoly Karlin, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Yep, always good to be on your show, Robert. Thank you.